doing it. There's a lot of work behind it, and it's really critical that folks have best practices that they're implementing to ensure that the programs are effective and helpful for the kids.
You know, Dr. Sarah Schwartz, is the goal, or what we trying to do out there, replicate something that we can, that's consistent on something that actually is pretty organic in its best form?
I would argue yes. I think that, and I would also mention that currently in the United States, the majority of youth mentors are those informal mentors who, you know, might not even know that they're doing mentoring, and that actually formal mentoring programs still reach only about 4% of youth in the, or only about 4% of youth who say they have a mentor that comes from a formal mentoring program, and that the majority are still these natural mentors where the relationship does form organically between the young person and adults in their community, whether it's, you know, a family friend, a religious leader, a coach, a teacher. But we also know that, again, the estimates are around half to a third of young people in the United States report never having had a mentor. So that's why we have these formal mentoring programs trying to come in and create these close relationships for young people who might not develop them naturally.
So, Elizabeth Joy, what qualities make a good mentor? And I'm thinking that most mentors probably don't know they are would make good mentors.
Yeah, it just starts with a caring heart. I mean, you know, you meet folks who think they don't have the time or, you know, because they're not, quote unquote, what they call successful, they think that they're not a great mentor. But, you know, in fact, folks who've been through maybe and have had some struggles along the way are great mentors because they can relate and connect. And research shows, and then that's with any relationship. When you think about even you and I, if you and I have similar journeys, regardless of our age, difference in our background, we're going to be able to connect. I'm going to be able to look to you and get that support from you. So it's really just starts with having a good heart and being committed. That's the other piece. You know, we know also that the longer that match happens, the longer that those two are connected, the more success we see with those relationships.
And
I would actually add to that, if you don't mind, that we've also seen in the research that prematurely terminating relationships. So if the mentor and the mentee agree to meet for, let's say, a year, if that relationship falls apart early, that actually can have negative effects on the young person. So they would have been better off never having had a mentor than having had a mentor who kind of abandoned them mid-year.
I volunteered in a reading program for a year and got really attached to the girl that I worked with, and I was never even allowed to know her last name. And I think about her a lot, you know, and it's been probably 15 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but the things, the good heart, the commitment, that is not something you can teach somebody, Elizabeth Joy.
Agreed. Right. So it starts with that. And then, but there is training. We suggest training because you can have a great heart and good intentions, but you know, oftentimes that may not be enough. If you really can't, if you're not able to connect, if you are not really strong in how to develop a relationship, if you don't really understand where these children are coming from, the trauma that they've experienced, the background that they have, then you can come in trying to quote unquote fix them. And then it becomes something else that, again, may not be as helpful. So we also know that training, while the good heart is the starting point, training is definitely an important piece for mentors to ensure that they have the tools to be able to connect well with these children and to go the distance within that relationship with their mentee.
What do we know about best practices, Sarah Schwartz, when it comes to linking mentors and mentees?
Great question. So we have some research that suggests that matching based on shared interests is a huge predictor of outcomes for youth and length of relationships. So if you can, again, this is what was already mentioned, but if you can find something in common between the young person and the mentor, that makes a big difference. We actually, some researchers are right now in the process of conducting a study that randomly is matching students and with mentors and is the goal is to come up with something almost like Match.com and dating algorithms to figure out what really makes a strong match in between a mentee and a mentor. So we're not yet at that level, but we do know that that factors such as shared interests makes a big difference, and taking into account mentee preferences. So for some mentees, it might be really important for them to have a mentor who shares their ethnic or cultural background. For another mentee, that might not be as salient for them, but it might be important to have a mentor who has specific interests that, who likes to play basketball if they like to play basketball. So it really is also mentor and family specific.
And I wonder also, Elizabeth Joy, to what extent mentees are very good at answering the questions that might come up in a Match.com kind of a scenario. I mean, how sophisticated they are about themselves.
More than we would think. Okay. I think we tend to underestimate children in general. But you know what? They can sense across the room if you're not real. They can mm-hmm. sense if you have a sense of entitlement or if you're looking down on them. That better than we can as adults. So maybe there's not a book that they've written, but they certainly know when they make that connection or have that first interaction, they can pretty much tell whether or not they feel like that person is going to be a good fit for them.
What's the criteria for being eligible to be a mentee? How do you know so many kids, they just have all kinds of mentors in their life growing up. How do you figure out who needs one?
Well, I think that depends on the program. There's certain programs who may decide that they want to focus on children. For example, Columbus City Schools has a mentoring program. I think they started off with seniors who were not on track to graduate. So they made that conscious choice to reach out to those folks. You have other mentoring programs that are just simply open for whoever wants to. You've got some programs that are specifically for refugee children who may be struggling with transition. So it just depends on the program and who they're seeking to reach out to, and then what mentees or mentors they're recruiting and who would be best matched.
Dr. Swartz? Are you there, Dr. Swartz?
Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I just got pulled away.
Sure. As far as, I'll repeat it, just as far as knowing and identifying kids who need mentorship.
Mm. Yeah, so I think, again, it does similarly vary based on program and what their specific mission is. You also mentioned there that, some kids already have a ton of mentors. And actually mm-hmm. a study that I did, what we saw is that for young people who already have really close relationships with teachers, parents, peers, that those kids actually don't seem to really benefit from a formal mentor. That, it doesn't hurt them, but they already have people who are functioning as mentors in their lives. So it seems like the kids who don't have those people in their lives are the ones who benefit more from mentoring, so higher levels of risk. Although, similarly, I think, if there's a kid, I'm a clinical psychologist, if there's a kid who really struggles with relationships and connecting with people, that that they may struggle also to connect with a volunteer mentor. So that mentor might need more intensive training for how to get through to a young person who has, been let down by every adult in their life.
And that's really the bottom line. These kids just need a caring adult in their world. And sometimes, unfortunately, their parents are not that, or they don't have, or they're the adult in their house because either mom is struggling with drug use or maybe mental health or what have you. So it's simply connecting them with a caring adult at its very core. That's what mentoring is.
I was thinking about the movie Moonlight. And the mentoring relationship in Moonlight is really interesting and complicated. It's the film. It's been nominated, for a couple different Academy Awards now. And, again, that was a casual, conscious decision on anyone's part. But it certainly had an impact on the kid.
Absolutely. And, again, we... my background is also a clinical. I'm a clinical licensed social worker. And so having worked with these kids in a really direct manner, knowing really at the very deepest level what they're really going through. If you're not in those shoes, you just wouldn't have any idea what you may see a kid every day. Say you're a teacher at school. You have no idea when that kid goes home. They don't even have a bed. They're not eating, what have you. So, you know, for your everyday person out here, this just seems, this can seem so casual that it's not a big deal. But when you really don't realize that true reality that these kids are facing, then you don't, then it's hard to really know that just something as simple as hanging out with them once a week or once a month can make that big of a difference, yeah, because that's the struggle that they're dealing with every day.
We're talking
about, and I think that consistency is really key as well.
Absolutely.
We're talking about mentoring today. That's Elizabeth Joy. She's executive director of the Mentoring Center of Central Ohio. It's a program of Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Central Ohio. And also with us by phone, Dr. Sarah Schwartz. She's assistant professor of psychology at Suffolk University. We will continue our conversation. Stay with us. And by the way, listeners, if you have a good mentoring story you want to share, a good example, what you think makes a good mentor, or, you know, if you were a mentee, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about mentoring and mentorship programs this hour. Lots of studies have shown the positive impacts a mentor can have on a young person, but those relationships are often lacking for those most in need. Still with us is assistant professor of psychology at Suffolk University, Dr. Sarah Schwartz. Her research focuses on prevention and intervention programs for children and adolescents, with a particular interest in youth mentoring. Also with us is executive director of the Mentoring Center of Central Ohio, Elizabeth Joy. And listeners, if you have a story about how a mentor changed your life, or if you have been a mentor yourself, give us a call. Tell us about it. 614-292-8513. Dr. Schwartz, you've done research on something called youth-initiated mentoring. Can you tell us what it is and what you've observed?
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that often we have two categories of mentoring. We have natural mentoring relationships or informal mentoring relationships that just form on their own between young people and adults in their community. And then we have formal mentoring relationships where a program matches a young person with a volunteer mentor who they've never met before. Youth-initiated mentoring is a hybrid model in some ways, where instead of assigning the young person a mentor, you work with them to identify an adult from their existing social network to become their mentor. So then they recruit that person to be their mentor, and it could be anyone from, you know, teacher, coach, bus driver, family friend. But what's exciting about this model is, one, it kind of taps a pool of people who might not go down and volunteer at their local Big Brothers Big Sisters agency, but it also really empowers the young people to identify someone in their life who they may already have some trust, so you're not necessarily starting from scratch.
And it's a skill you can use throughout your life, too, to find those people in your life over time.
Yeah. And actually, some colleagues and I have actually adapted the youth-initiated mentoring model to really create a curriculum or training workshops that teach young people the skills to recruit mentors and more broadly social capital throughout their lives. So the idea that, you know, we know relationships are so important both for supporting us emotionally as well as for, you know, giving us internships and opportunities. So if we can teach young people to really be able to take advantage of those relationships and reach out and connect and ask for help when they need it, that can have powerful effects, you know, throughout their lives.
Is that something you work on with Big Brothers Big Sisters, and in other words, helping the young people make choices for themselves when it comes to mentors?
We do. They're certainly involved in giving them a voice as far as who might be a good match for them. But as far as going as far as them reaching out, we do that some. It just depends. Again, mm-hmm. with my hat, I'm kind of wearing this hat of all of these different organizations that we serve. But certainly when you can allow the choices, the child's voice to be heard, not just in who they're selecting as a mentor, but just anything on a day to day. We tend to forget as adults that, you know, they're pretty much told everything, when to get up, what to eat, what not, you name it. So anytime you can give a child a voice and give them an opportunity to have an influence on what's being decided for their lives, it's certainly going to positively influence the outcome.
How has technology, things like social media, video games, and that sort of thing, changed mentoring programs? I know people do mentoring almost exclusively online in some cases. Elizabeth Joy?
Well, it's you know, I think there's pros and cons to it. Obviously, the pros to that is that perhaps you can connect more often. You can meet people where they are. Of course, with the younger generation, they tend to enjoy, you know, the social media elements more. However, on the concern side is, you know, where's the line for safety and boundaries and what have you? And, you know, we're still kind of finding our way through that. But, you know, again, depending on what mentoring program you have some, like in your case, where you didn't even know the last name.
Right.
If you're doing a school-based mentoring program, you're not going to have any contact with them whatsoever outside
of that hour. Yeah.
And then when you do community-based, it's a little more flexible. But again, like, where's that line? Where's the boundary? And how do we make sure? Because you want to be supportive to these children. But, you know, again, the safety element, not only from, you know, background checks and that kind of safety, but the safety of their mental health of what does this look like? How involved are you? And so, again, it's, you know, there's pros and cons. And I think we're going to continue to learn how do we implement that and incorporate it into what we do, but also make sure that we're making good choices and that the outcomes are good for these kids. Because as we've already stated, it's not a guarantee that there's a positive outcome. There are some things that could cause this not to go well. So we want to be sure that we're thinking about those things.
Still lots to learn on that score. Dr. Swartz, what about technology?
Yeah, I actually, again, with colleagues recently wrote a paper on the use of technology in formal youth mentoring programs. And what we saw is, one, just that it's being used hugely, and that programs don't quite know how to manage it yet. Mm-hmm. because it's, you know, it's suddenly there, and often in their guidelines, there aren't necessarily guidelines or there weren't guidelines about how mentors and mentees should handle this. So what that means is, again, it's being used in a lot of different ways. I think in some ways that are really positive and are, you know, helping young people to connect more. And, you know, young people who we heard stories from mentors who, you know, their mentee would never come and tell them, you know, I feel really depressed because, you know, I got in a fight with my best friend, but they'll text that. And that somehow having, again, that slight disconnection of I'm sharing this over text versus in person, kind of staring into your eyes, that they felt much more comfortable. So they actually found that their mentees were able to share much more with them than they would have otherwise. That said, you know, as Elizabeth Joy spoke of, that there are also a host of safety concerns and boundary issues that I think need to be addressed, and that more and more in trainings and program guidelines, that programs need to be talking about how their mentees can and cannot use social media and technology with their mentees.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you're listening and interested in sharing your own story about mentoring, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Brandon in Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, good morning. Almost afternoon, I guess.
Yeah.
So I've been involved in a mentoring program in the past in California. I moved here about a year and a half ago, and I look forward to being involved in one here. I run a successful local car detailing business called Car Dorks, and I found that, you know, as a small business owner, especially in a kind of community-based business where I'm working with and for my neighbors, I found that I have a special obligation to be involved in programs like mentoring, because it gives a whole different look of what success can be. You know, like when you talk to a kid or an adolescent, say, what, you know, what how do you define success? a lot of times they say, oh, you know, Google or Apple or, you know, these huge tech companies, and they can, the gap between adolescence and being a mogul is so vast that they can't possibly fathom what it, you know, how can I be successful and not be the CEO of a tech giant?
Yeah.
And so being able to share my experiences of working for and with my neighbors and being able to provide for my family and give a good product and at the end of the day, hang my hat on the door and say that I had a great day and I'm proud of the work that I did, I think gives, you know, these these teenagers, what, you know, whatever age it would be that the mentee would be, gives them a, you know, a different and special perspective that can kind of challenge that, you know, that preconception that I have no idea how I can possibly be successful because the success to them is making $1 million a year.
Right. Interesting. Brandon, thank you so much. Yes.
I think that, goes to the point I was saying earlier about, you know, sometimes you have folks that don't mentor because they think that they have to be that mogul. And it's like, it's so not about that. And we also have to remember, for a lot of these kids, when we say success, we're not even talking about whether you can start a business. I mean, there's some kids are grateful enough to be in that space, but success is being alive tomorrow. Success is being able to have a meal tonight. So again, like so many people, I think, count themselves out. We are in a mentoring work group that just was launched here with the Columbus City Schools and the City of Columbus, and we had a workshop last week, and we were talking specifically about recruiting African-American male mentors, and that was some of the research that was shared as for them not feeling like they have something to bring. But absolutely, you do. The fact that you're here, the fact that you know, the statistics said you wouldn't make it past 24 and you're 35, that in itself is success. And so we have to be careful not only of what we're thinking the kids think is success, but what we think is success.
Interesting. Yeah. Sarah Schwartz?
Yeah, I think Brandon also spoke to the importance of mentors in influencing young people's goals and future orientation, and that's a really important outcome that we see among mentored youth, of being able to kind of conceptualize a future for themselves. And Elizabeth Joy spoke of, you know, also that, you know, among a lot of young people, they have this foreshortened sense of the future of, you know, why should I be planning for 30 because I'm not going to be here when I'm 30, and that's actually a huge predictor of risky behavior, and that if we can instill in young people a sense of I do have a future, then we see a lot more positive outcomes in so many areas of their lives, and that mentors can be really important people who give that message to young people of I have a future and I can imagine what it might look like.
Brandon, thanks again for that call. I wanted to turn to Belinda now in Columbus. You're on the air. Belinda, hi.
This is a great topic. Thanks. I have thought a great deal about this. I was a child that grew up in the 60s and 70s in the middle of the Vietnam War, and OSU students going down High Street, the State House, protesting when Victorian Village was a burned out business area. Mm-hmm. I grew up right at Hubbard and High, and mentoring really saved my life. I grew up in a large dysfunctional family, and I needed to be taken away from that. I was very lucky to have two mentors, a husband and wife, Judge Kenneth Sater, who was a municipal court judge at the time, and his wife, Mrs. Margaret Sater, who sort of took me under the wing. They lived around the corner on Park Street, and they had a large home, and it was sort of like an alcove away from the neighborhood. Mrs. Sater was just brilliant about taking me out of the neighborhood so I could see other possibilities. She would take me to films to see that she thought that I needed to see. She assigned me to Godman Guild. She taught me about how to recycle and to send oranges to Africa to help children that were starving. The other thing that I thought was really good is that at the time, President Johnson thought that there needed to be a program to help children in inner city grow up to be leaders. And he started the Youth Corps in memory of President Kennedy. And I was one of those Youth Corps members for 3 years. And I was taught leadership and to participate in my community and job skills. I even had a test proctoring job in a U.S. Navy station on Heaton Road for a summer, helping Navy recruits, which I kind of worry about now, who went to Vietnam War. And then there was a church, a United Methodist church in my neighborhood, who had a very serious youth program that was very active in the community, and they really embraced me. And I think it was all those factors together that raised that thing that used to be said about it takes the community to raise a child, and it's an entire community to help. I'm so grateful.
Belinda, thank you so much. That sounds like it's had an incredible impression on your life and shaped you in so many ways. I really appreciate your sharing that.
Thank you.
Yep. Take care. Thank you for listening.
And we need more mentors. We don't have enough folks. And when you hear a story like that, if you've been on the fence, let us know. We'll help you match. I mean, you and I just talked about some of the challenges you have, Anne. There's so many different programs we can find a fit, whether it's time that you think is a challenge or resources that you think is a challenge. There is a mentoring relationship and organization that would be a good fit. There's so many different ways to do it.
You know, I wanted to drill down into something that we just heard about, you know, the religious component. Dr. Swartz, is there any research out there about how faith-based mentorship compares to others?
So I'm not aware of any research showing that one or the other is more effective. Mm-hmm. I can say that there's substantial literature showing that, you know, whether it's a faith-based organization or an organization that, you know, is through school or community setting, that if you're able to recruit caring adult mentors and volunteers, that's where the power is. And there's been a lot of really successful faith-based organizations, because often that's a community where you have adults who really want to do service to their community and support the young people in their community, and faith-based mentoring organizations do have a lot of evidence behind what they do, as well as heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do we hear about what mentors get out of this? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what real relationships are. It's a two-way street.
Probably the greatest untold story of mentoring is that, you know, you think you're joining this opportunity or this organization to help someone, and you are, but it's untold as to the blessings that come back. I mean, there's research on what's called the helper's high. Anytime you're involved in helping someone else, you're going to have that feeling inside of you for knowing that you contributed. But it also is a mirror. I mean, when you're sitting across from a young child, you know, they're the most honest people in the world, right? And so you really get a chance to know yourself and grow, because they do push you and challenge you, but you know, it's in love. So, you know, we hear stories all the time about mentors and how much their lives have been changed by their mentee. A matter of fact, Big Brothers Big Sisters just had our annual luncheon earlier this year, and we had some videos where we interviewed the young person, the mentee, and had them tell the mentor what that mentor meant to them. And then they had the video camera rolling while the mentor watched the video. And just to see their faces when they heard what the mentee had to say about them was just, of course, it's totally a makeup ruining opportunity, right?
Right. Misty-eyed all around. What about mentor dropout? What do we know about that, Sarah Schwartz? Is it a problem, or is there some more that can be done to encourage them to stay?
Yeah, but thank you for bringing that up. It is a problem, and I think you know, on the one hand, we always need more mentors, because there's so many young people out there who need mentors, and we want to make sure that when mentors are coming, that they're going to be able to meet their commitments. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean the relationship needs to end in a lifetime relationship, mm-hmm. but that means that they need to stay for the amount of time that they told that kid and that program that they would be there. And unfortunately, there is a much too high mentor dropout rate. The data, you know, varies by program, but numbers have estimated anywhere between about 20 to 50% of mentors don't actually meet their full commitment of the time that they said they would.
And I should say,
the relationship ends prematurely. So sometimes that's because the young person moved or the young person stopped showing up. But it actually, in more cases, is because the mentor stopped showing up. And again, often there might be real reasons for that, they moved, they got a new job, they had a kid themselves. So, that it's understandable, but the impact on the young person is real. So I think it's really important to make sure that when mentors are making that commitment, that they really understand what that commitment means. And again, often the commitment is only 1 year. Sometimes if it's school-based mentoring, it might be 9 months. So it's not too long, but it's really important that they can really meet that commitment. And I think another piece in terms of being able to address the dropout rate is making sure that mentors have clear expectations about what mentoring looks like when they start. And I think that sometimes mentors come in and they expect from, day one, they're going to feel like a savior their mentee will love them and will just be so excited to see them. And, their kids and and we actually see that as mentees get older, that relationships fall apart more quickly because, particularly teenagers, they're not going to greet you like you're their best friend, before you've earned that trust. So I think it's really important to adjust mentors' expectations to let them know, it won't be that you mean everything to them from day one, but if you keep showing up, even on those days where they seem kind of pissed off at you, but you're still there for them, that's where the power lies. And I think also, kids, teenagers don't always tell you how they feel. So sometimes the mentor will think, oh, I don't actually mean anything to them. They don't care about me. And then if you go talk to the kid, years later, they'll still be able to talk about that mentor. Right. But the mentor will think, I wasn't important to them.
Dr. Sarah Schwartz, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's Dr. Sarah Schwartz. She's assistant professor of psychology at Suffolk University and studies the impacts of mentoring. And also Elizabeth Joy, executive director of the Mentoring Center of Central Ohio. Thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us and thanks for covering this important topic.
We're going to cover another aspect of the topic coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Larry, tell us about your experience in bringing Six in the City to schools and what inspired this take on it.
You know, the students and the teachers inspired this take on the Six in the City project. And as a lot of listeners hopefully know by now, because I've been yelling about it for 2 years in Columbus with much enthusiasm and a wonderful community here. Six in the City and the Six Word Memoir Projects ask you to sum up your life or your life about your city, what it is, what it means to you, what you want it to be in exactly 6 words. I've been in so many schools across the country, but very much so here in Columbus. And students share their 6-word stories. And sometimes we stop and say, hey, tell me more. Tell me a little bit more about that story. And in these moments in the classrooms when students open up their stories and I see classmates learning things about them and hearing things a different way. For example, we've been working on an immigration project, 6 words in immigration. And one student said in 6 words, nervously got up and said, my name is not Mamacita, okay? And there was a pause and then rousing applause by her classmates. So that kind of thing has inspired me to do something I've been doing for years, which is these backstory shows. They're themed on love, on life, on Columbus as a fertile ground for creativity, in which 6 to 8 storytellers start with their 6-word memoir, a headline or a teaser, and then they kind of reveal the backstory in 6 to 8 minutes. At most of my shows, I've had perhaps one student or two, and then adults and some professional storytellers, some new to the format. But the reaction from students who, when you hear them, they don't seem like students or younger storytellers. They're just good storytellers because they work hard, has been so overwhelming and emotional and meaningful. I thought, I want that feeling, those reactions, when Chloe White got a standing ovation, a junior at the ACPA school at the Wexner Center last May. I want that feeling. I want it 8 times. And that's what we're going to have on March 1st at Shadowbox. We have 8 amazing storytellers, some told in music, some spoken words, some poetry. We're going to have 8 of them who have worked their butts off. They're going to create a memorable evening.
So tell us about our other guests, Kim I'm sorry, is it Sarai?
It's Sarah.
Sarah, okay. Kim and Sarah, how did they, what triggered this for you when it came to them?
Well, when I thought about doing what I call the student mentor show, the good news is there were amazing choices. I've spent the last 2 years in Columbus being inside schools, meeting people who are really just wonderful mentors to students of all types across the city. So it was easy. It was just a matter of talking to folks I've worked with and saying, hey, here's what we're up to. Is there a student who either you know well or maybe don't know that well but want to know better that you want to spend some time with and get them ready for the show? And Kim, and I'll let Kim talk about her work, she's an educator at the Mosaic School, which is just an amazing place. I've been in her classrooms a number of times, and I thought, hey, her class could do their own show, but I asked Kim if she could think about a student she'd like to work with.
And Sarah really jumped into my mind because I remember when Larry first came to Columbus and started Six in the City, you had a booth at Independence Day, and I think Sarah was one of the first young people to come up and do her own six-word memoir. So this is really nice that we kind of started together, and now it's Sarah's senior year, and we're ending together. And Sarah is an amazing writer. One of the reasons I like to be a teacher and I like to work with teenagers is that they have such amazing stories of growing into who they are and their identity. And I know kind of in the world, people think of teenagers as these crazy kids bouncing around Easton. But the teenagers I work with, you know, have such heart and such voice. And Sarah goes out into the world and she loves the city. And I'm just so proud of her to represent the Mosaic program.
Yeah, I think it's actually really funny that Kim talks so highly of me because that's exactly how I talk about Kim and the rest of the of my Mosaic facilitators. I think that I have I actually have like a very interesting like school life. So I go to the Mosaic program in the morning and then I go to a public school in the afternoon. I go to Hilliard Bradley. And I have such amazing teachers at Hilliard Bradley. But when it comes to my Mosaic teachers, my Mosaic facilitators, they go so like above and beyond to just not just be teachers, but to be mentors. You know, I always like to say that the best math teachers are the ones that care about the problems offside or like not on the piece of paper that they give you. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what Kim and Steve and everybody at Mosaic does for me. Right. They care so much about my well-being and me as a person that in effect, that really helps me be like the best student that I could possibly be.
You know, Larry Smith, I bet you teacher-student relationship, that mentor-mentee relationship, comes up a lot in what you do.
I mean, it's one of the truest cliches in the world, which is one person can change your life. And I think about the mentors I've had in my life, you know, my Latin teacher, my English teacher. And as I've spent time with each of these pairs of mentor-mentees, it's just so interesting. So I was with David Brown is a mentor from the Harmony Project.
Right.
He's mentoring an amazing young man named DJ White, who's this musical spoken word poet. And, you know, DJs, he doesn't need help with his poetry, but they talked a lot about presence and how you stand and how you hold the mic. And think about it. That work together will take him through toasts and eulogies and public speaking and maybe, you know, maybe in job interviews. And we all need help with all these things, right? So that coaching, that working together, it's more than just getting ready for the show. It's about just life skills.
Yeah, these are the kind of skills we call soft skills, and they're just as important as the testing skills, but because they can't be tested in a traditional school situation, we don't pay as much attention to them. But at the Mosaic program, the students are setting up interviews their junior year with people to do research. They're out in the world, and these soft skills, being able to do a great handshake or just call someone out of the blue and advocate for yourself, are just as important. So when Larry's talking about us coaching these young people, we're not just coaching them with knowledge, but how to be in the world.
Right, exactly. And I've experienced that firsthand as being a second year Mosaic student. I used to be very awkward when it came to, job interviews or even meeting new people. But after being at Mosaic, the facilitators really boosted up my my self-esteem and my confidence to go out into the world. And they would always push me to, you know, be part of my city, be part of Columbus and go out there. And that just made me so much more confident in who I am, right? And that allowed me to go to job interviews and just completely, you know, hit that ball out of the ball, you know, out of the ballpark and just be around so many different people and not get nervous and go up on a stage and
talk. Come on a radio show.
Yeah, exactly.
And what do you think was that tipping point for you at Mosaic where it went from being instruction to mentoring?
Oh, wow. I think it definitely has to do with relationship, of course. I think that is the foundation of it all. I think that when, you know, in public school, you have these amazing teachers, but they focus a lot on, you know, on giving you this test, right? And that's it, though, right? But I think the tipping point for me was when I arrived to Mosaic and a teacher asked me things like, you know, who are you? What is your driving force? When they started asking me questions that were not on on a booklet, right? They started asking me about questions, more personal questions, and I think that in creating that relationship with me and caring about me as a person, that I mean, changed everything for me. That allowed me to be a better student.
Yeah.
I want to just note that, Sarah, are you 17?
Yeah, I'm 17.
I mean, you speak as if you're a wise 35-year-old. You know, just let's remember, Sarah's 17.
Reality check.
You know, the range of the show, we have, we have two of our most beloved poets coaching students, Amy Turn-Sharp and Barbara Fant. Amy's young poet is 12. Barbara's student, Katarina, is doing a poetry and a story kind of mashup. And we have a 21-year-old who's Stacey Board, who runs Shadowbox, who she coached in theater, but now he's in sort of tech and he's sort of, you know, graduating into real life. But what he learned from Stacey in the arts world has infused his world in technology. And I'm very lucky and grateful that I personally am coaching a woman named Sarah Rashad, and she came to Columbus at age 13 from Syria as a refugee. And if I didn't tell you that, and you hear her speak, she's been in the world of poetry slams in Columbus, TEDx. I mean, she's already a rock star. She doesn't need my help. But if I didn't tell you that, and you hear her speak at the show, tell her story, you would think, I mean, her grammar's better than mine. And she, I wouldn't want to give away her story, but she has had an amazing life, and she is so grounded and wonderful. And she will take us from that journey, a 13-year-old in Syria, to Columbus in the Centennial School where she now goes.
It sounds like an incredible program. That's Six in the City Columbus Live. It'll take place next week at Shadowbox Live. And for more information, you can visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And also, I just want to let people know if they're interested in the Mentoring Center of Central Ohio, we'll have a link to that as well on our website. I want to thank Sarah Castilla for she's a student mentee. She'll be performing at Six in the City Columbus Live. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And also Kim Letty, teacher, journalist, and mentor. Thanks to you as well, Kim.
Thank you.
And Larry Smith, as always, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
What a pleasure, Ann.
That's Larry Smith. He's founding editor of Smith Magazine and creator of the Six Word Memoirs Project and Six in the City. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, the All Sides interns Sarah Stacey, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like us on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at Ann Fisher, WOSU, and you can follow the program on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.